This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and at 13 hours GMT on Monday, the 14th of October, these are our main stories. Israel says the Hezbollah drone strike on a military training camp was a painful blow. But Israel has continued to hit targets in Lebanon and Gaza, including a food distribution centre and a hospital in the Palestinian territory. And China says it's completed large-scale military exercises encircling Taiwan. Also in this podcast, the spacecraft hunting for signs of the possibility of alien life on Jupiter's moon Europa. It's due to blast off from Florida.
I'd be very surprised if we didn't find the ingredients for life somewhere in our solar system.
We begin with events in the Middle East. Gaza's Hamas-run health ministry says more than 60 people have been killed by Israeli strikes over the last 24 hours. 10 were killed and dozens were wounded at a food distribution centre in the Jabalia refugee camp in the north. Meanwhile, Israel's army chief has admitted that a drone strike by the Lebanon-based group Hezbollah on a military training base that killed 4 soldiers in central Israel on Sunday was a major blow. Dozens of other soldiers were injured. General Herzi Halevi said an attack on a military target on the home front was difficult. A spokesman for the Israeli Defense Forces, Daniel Hagari, travelled to the scene of the attack.
We're managing the incident, and we will learn from and investigate how an unmanned aerial vehicle broke through without warning and hit the base. The threat of UAVs is a threat that we've been dealing with since the beginning of the war. We need an improvement to our defence.
Our correspondent Jonah Fisher, who's in northern Israel, gave us this update.
The Minister of Defence and the Chief of Staff of the Israeli military have been at that base near Binyamina this morning, looking for answers as to what went wrong yesterday. Just to give you a little bit of context, we're up right near the border with South Lebanon. There are often jets flying overhead. We sometimes see interceptions by the Iron Dome air defense system, which Israel has in place. Often they are just in the sky above us here. That is largely intercepting rockets, which the Hezbollah militants are firing from South Lebanon. They have a fairly predictable trajectory, which makes them easier to shoot down. Drones are a whole altogether different proposition, and what appears to have happened last night, according to Israeli media reports who've seen parts of the initial investigation by the IDF, is that there was a sustained barrage of fire across a particular area of the border between South Lebanon and Israel, and during that, 2 drones went into the Mediterranean Sea. One of them was taken down by the Israeli military, but another one was lost. And it was that drone which, according to these reports, then went on to hit the canteen of the army base near Binyamina, causing so many casualties.
In Lebanon, the health ministry says 51 people were killed by Israeli strikes across the country on Sunday. Our correspondent Jonathan Head is in Beirut and has been to a neighbourhood which has been repeatedly hit by airstrikes.
Not far away from where I am now, this was the location where there were 2 Israeli airstrikes on Thursday, a neighbourhood called Basta. A very typical Beirut neighbourhood, up a hill, very narrow streets, buildings all around, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 stories, very residential. And going in there, you really have a tremendous sense of the damage that these Israeli bombs do. Remember, Israel describes these strikes as precise, surgical. We know they're very accurate. Yet an entire building had completely vanished. I mean, there was just piles of broken concrete, and all the cars around had been completely mangled. I mean, it was incredible how wrecked they were. So the residents had piled the cars and a lot of the rubble up on the sides of the street, meaning it was very hard for any vehicles to get through while they go through trying to salvage what they can and figure out how they can rebuild, because all the buildings next to this one building, which has basically been pulverized into nothing, all the other buildings are damaged too. So you've got great gaping holes in the walls, curtains flapping in the breeze, and just a stunned population. This is not a known Hezbollah area. People there don't understand why they were targeted, and we haven't yet had any confirmation of what the Israeli bombing was targeting in that particular place, or whether they actually managed to kill their target. That has not yet been confirmed. And the point about it is that, you know, with this, obviously this Hezbollah attack on Israel, that's a reminder that this conflict has got a long way to go. I mean, Israel is bogged down now fighting Hezbollah in the south of the country in its land operation. The airstrikes have not come back to Beirut over the weekend. There's been two or three days without any airstrikes here at all. But there are multiple airstrikes every day across other parts of Lebanon as Israel continues to try and damage Hezbollah's capacity to send rockets and drones into Israel. And it looks like that's going to take a long time. So we're going to see more of these devastating airstrikes that always have huge amounts of collateral damage and civilian damage. I mean, this neighborhood I went into is going to take a very long time for it to be rebuilt. And of course, huge numbers of families have had to move out and find somewhere else to go. And that's a pattern you see right across this country.
Jonathan Head in Beirut. China has carried out large-scale military drills in the sea and air surrounding Taiwan. Just a few days ago, Taiwan's President Lee Ching-te vowed to resist annexation by Beijing. China sees Taiwan as a breakaway province. This is our correspondent in Beijing, Stephen McDonnell.
What this appears to be from the People's Liberation Army is something of a dress rehearsal for a blockade. If they wanted to genuinely surround Taiwan, stop ships from coming in and out, and potentially, you know, bring the country, the government there, you know, to its knees as a means of forcing Taiwan to rejoin mainland China, this is potentially how you would do it. And according to the official statements of the PLA, these exercises are involving sort of coordinating the army, the air force, the rocket force, the navy, to take out key ports, to take out important areas on the landmass of Taiwan, as well as sea targets. And this is what is being practiced right now. Now, it's hard for us to see from a distance the scale of this, but it certainly looks to be quite significant. And if you look at the areas of the maps that have been released by the PLA, it's all around Taiwan. So, you know, north, south, east, west, there are areas where this is being carried out.
Taiwan has described the manoeuvres as irrational and provocative behaviour. Lai Ching-te has held an emergency meeting with security officials. Karen Kuo is a spokeswoman for Taiwan's presidential office.
At present, the international community's consensus is to maintain peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait and the Indo-Pacific region. China should face the fact and the existence of the Republic of China, Taiwan, respect the choice of the Taiwanese people for a democratic and free lifestyle, and refrain from military provocations that would jeopardize the peace and stability of the region and threaten Taiwan's democracy and freedom.
Rupert Wingfield Hayes is our correspondent in the Taiwanese capital, Taipei.
Taiwan's response, I would say, on the whole, has been fairly modest and fairly, you know, they are resisting the temptation to react, if you like. Certainly at a political level, the political leadership said, you know, what we need to do now is stay calm and not do anything that will provoke the situation with China further. But at the same time, obviously, Taiwan's military, given the fact that there are so many Chinese forces around the island, has seen the need to put the military on high alert. We've seen ships going to sea, we've seen aircraft taking off from air bases, and we've seen them deploying anti-aircraft missile systems at various places around the island. So they are preparing for any eventuality. But I think the political response is, look, we just need to remain calm and let China do this. There's nothing we can do to stop them, so we will just monitor it and not do anything to make it worse.
So that's the political response. What about the people, though? What's the atmosphere like where you are, and are people concerned?
I think in the immediate short term, people are not concerned. If you ask people here on the streets, this is not the first time it's happened. This is the second time we've seen big exercises this year. It's the third time we've seen really large scale exercises since 2022. China's rhetoric has been getting more fierce. And the number of incursions that take place into Taiwan airspace and across the middle line in the Taiwan Straits have been growing significantly in recent months. Everybody thinks this is political intimidation. Most people say they do not think there is any imminent threat of invasion from China. But I think there is a sense that the long-term prospect for military conflict between Taiwan and China has grown significantly in the last decade, and there doesn't seem to be a political solution. Taiwan and Beijing are not talking to each other at any level, and they now seem, you know, their rhetoric is implacable. Beijing says is going to get Taiwan back, and Taiwan says we're an independent sovereign nation, although our name is the Republic of China, and we are not going to be annexed by China. So I think in that respect, you know, I think if we're talking in the next 5 to 10 years, I think there is growing concern of a potential conflict between the two.
That was Rupert Wingfield Hayes in Taiwan. Fierce fighting has been continuing in Ukraine's eastern Donetsk region, particularly close to the town of Pokrovsk. Russian forces have been advancing and the front line is now just outside it. 2 months ago, Pokrovsk was considered a relatively safe place and thousands of civilians remain there. Our correspondent Yogita Lemoye sent this report from close to the front line, and we should warn you, you may find some of her report distressing.
I'm at a Ukrainian military stabilization unit, which is not far from the front line outside of Pokrovsk. These are basically units that are about 10 to 12 kilometers from the front line, where wounded soldiers are brought in, where the first line of medical treatment is available for injured soldiers. This is the hottest front line in the war. And they've told us that it's been really quite intense here over the last 1 or 2 months.
My name is Alexander. I'm chief of medical unit 25 Air Assault Brigade. It's the most dangerous line in all front lines. And we have a lot of attacks every day. And of course, we have a lot of injured soldiers.
It's about 2 hours from sunset, and we've just had about 6 or 7 injured soldiers brought in, some quite serious. There's one soldier who's just walked past who has a bandage to his eye, quite visibly it's bleeding.
He has injury of face skull. It's like a skull trauma.
The delays have consequences. One of the soldiers has serious brain trauma. Another might have to have his arm amputated. In the past 24 hours, 2 have been brought in dead. What we see points to the ferocity of the battle for Pokrovsk and what it's costing Ukraine. We're with an evacuation unit in an ambulance in the city of Pokrovsk. They're here to evacuate 2 elderly women, and one of them actually lives on the eastern edge of the city, very close to the Russian positions. This is one of the most dangerous districts of the city, volunteer Serhii tells us. Eighty-year-old Nadia Lebed is disabled, living alone in the dark in her home. The volunteers we're with carry her out. I'm going to fall, she screams. They reassure her. Once on the van, she cries, I'm going to die, this damn war. Why does Putin want more land? Doesn't he have enough? Another evacuee, Victoria, says she can't believe the front line moved so quickly to Pokrovsk.
The neighboring towns have been wiped out and drones buzz near our windows all the time. I have constant panic attacks. We should negotiate. There's nothing left standing in the areas Russia has taken anyway.
There are pockets of destruction in Pokrovsk, but the city has not been bombed out in the way that we've seen other cities that have been fiercely fought over, like what we saw in Bakhmut, for example. But 3/4 of the people who lived here have left, and the government is actively asking those who are still here to evacuate. And that's evidence of how quickly Russia's advanced here in the east. Up until 2 months ago, this was a safe pit stop. And now the front line's just outside Pokrovsk, and constantly you can hear the sound of bombardment from there.
We met 20-year-old Roman, who was repairing a home damaged in shelling.
I think some negotiations have to take place. We have to stop this war. I don't think the territory we're fighting for is worth human lives.
It's nearly the break of dawn, and we're being driven by the Ukrainian military to a position on the outskirts of Pokrovsk. One of the reasons to do this drive in the dead of the night was to avoid being seen by Russian drones.
Vadim fires a Soviet-era howitzer gun. It blows dust and dried leaves off the ground. In the relative safety of a bunker nearby, he tells us it's been nearly a year since he saw his family.
Yes, we are tired. Many of our men have died. Many are wounded. Negotiations are necessary, but not on Russia's terms. They need to be on our terms.
Ukraine knows what's at stake. If Pokrovsk falls, it could open a gateway to central parts of the country. We leave the position quickly before Russia starts firing.
Move, please. That report from Yogita Lemoye in Ukraine. Now, it's that perennial, fascinating question. Is there life beyond our world? Well, as we record this podcast, a NASA mission is due to blast off from Florida, bound for Europa, one of the moons of the planet Jupiter. The aim is to explore its icy surface and see if it harbours the potential for life. It's some 700 million kilometres away. Professor Michelle Doherty has previously led unmanned exploratory missions to Saturn and Jupiter.
If you're looking for life in our solar system, and the first thing we do is we look for liquid water, you don't have to focus close to the sun. You can move beyond what's called the snow line, which is just beyond the Earth. You can go much beyond that, and you can find liquid water, but it's not on the surface. It's in the interior of the moons of Jupiter, moons of Saturn, potentially those of Uranus and Neptune as well. I'd be very surprised if we didn't find the ingredients for life somewhere in our solar system.
Our science correspondent, Georgina Ranard, told us more about the probe, named the Europa Clipper, and its mission.
There are lots of space launches going on at the moment, and people may get a bit fatigued. But I think what's so exciting about this one is they're going to this really distant moon, and they think they might find evidence of life there. So it's this hunt for alien life. It's quite a cool moon, I think. It's called Europa. It's orbiting Jupiter. It's got this very mysterious geology. It's covered in ice, 25 kilometres of ice, which is, we've only got 5 kilometres on Earth. And underneath that, they think there's this saltwater ocean. But they don't really know. And it's that combination of geology, possibly chemistry, that means they may find evidence of life there.
They aren't going to find it soon, though, are they?
No, it's quite sad, isn't it? It's 6 years away. So we get really excited today. This launch should hopefully go off in a few hours' time, and then we have to wait until 2030. But they have quite an interesting route. They have to do a flyby. They orbit Earth and Mars because they have to pick up off the gravity of those two planets because it's such a long distance. So we'll sort of have those moments when we see it go around Earth and Mars, and they pick up off the gravity and sort of sling back off towards Jupiter. Basically, it's such a long distance to Jupiter, they can't just use fuel. It has been done before. It's called slingshot effect, and they use the gravitational field of Earth and Mars. And if you can kind of imagine it, they go back into orbit and they are able to move around with the orbit of those two planets, and it propels them further towards Jupiter.
And once they get to where they're going, how's it going to work? Are they going to land? What's happening?
So they won't land, but they're going to try and do 50, more or less, flybys of Europa. It's a really radiated environment, so there's huge amounts of radiation that come from Jupiter. Actually, each time they go around Europa, the spacecraft will be exposed to about the same radiation as a million X-rays. And so they'll do that, and then each time they can get about 15 kilometres above the surface, and they've got all these instruments on board. They've got spectrometers, radar, and that will look through the ice. It will collect all this data. And then at the end, it's the end of the spacecraft. It doesn't come back to Earth, and it sort of goes off and is destroyed. But what we will get, what all the scientists will get, is all that data from the instruments.
That was our science correspondent, Georgina Ranard. Still to come in this podcast, a three-armed robotic conductor makes a debut in Germany.
I believe a person can always do better, but if you have a piece that capitalises on the fact that the orchestra plays at different speeds in different beats, then it makes sense.
In 2018, a woman named Dawn Sturgis died in southwest England after coming into contact with the nerve agent Novichok. It was the same chemical weapon used against a former Russian spy some months earlier. Sergei Skripal, who's thought to have also worked for British intelligence, and his daughter Yulia were left critically ill but survived. A few hours ago, a British public inquiry got underway to establish what happened. Officials here have blamed Russia. Moscow has consistently denied any involvement. Barrister Andrew O'Connor led the opening statements at the inquiry.
We must not, and we will not, lose sight of Dawn Sturges, the individual, and of her family's grief. It is not possible to investigate Dawn Sturges's death properly without understanding the Skripal poisoning.
Marie Lennon, a BBC reporter, covered the events at the time of the poisonings. She told Michelle Hussein more about the public inquiry and about Dawn Sturges herself.
She was a mum of three, and back in 2018, she came into contact with Novichok, one of the most deadly substances in the world, in what she thought was a bottle of perfume. Now, it's believed the bottle was discarded by the people who poisoned former Russian spy Sergei Skripal 4 months earlier. And the inquiry itself, the reason it's an inquiry is because of the scale of questions around what happened, but also because some of the evidence given relates to national security and intelligence gathering. So some hearings will be able to be held behind closed doors to protect that intelligence and also the identity of the witnesses, but also all of the evidence given will be on a 10-minute time delay from the public and from the media to make sure that none of those identities are accidentally released, causing potential harm to those involved. What we will hear, though, publicly is from lots of people who investigated Dawn's death and also dealt with what happened. So the people who treated her, paramedics, hospital staff, local and counter-terror police, public health and others.
She had three children, didn't she? One wonders if they'll ever get the full answers to the story of this nerve agent and how it was used.
Yeah, she did have three children and who have spent the last 6.5 years grappling with the fact that their mum died in the most extraordinary circumstance. And the family have spoken before about the death of Dawn becoming public property almost, and not really getting many answers. There are some things that we do know. We do know that she was poisoned with Novichok. And as I say, it was hidden in a perfume bottle, which was found by her partner, Charlie Rowley, who had no idea what was inside. It is thought that it was discarded by the same people who tried to poison former Russian spy Sergei Skripal 4 months earlier. In relation to that, there have been charges authorised against three men who are believed to be GRU agents. But that's for the poisoning of Sergei Skripal. Those charges don't relate to Dawn Sturges. And actually, because they're Russian citizens and the Russian state doesn't allow the extradition of their citizens, they can't be put on trial. So it's really hoped that this inquiry will at least give the family some answers around the circumstances of Dawn's death, how it happened, could it have been prevented, and where responsibility lies. But justice is going to be a lot harder to find for them at the moment.
That was Marie Lennon. Health officials in Zimbabwe have confirmed the country's first two cases of Mpox. The World Health Organization declared a global public health emergency in August after a new type of the virus spread from the Democratic Republic of Congo to neighboring countries. Shinga Nyoka is in Harare.
The health ministry has recorded two cases of Mpox, the first an 11-year-old boy in the capital city Harare, the second a 24-year-old man in southern Zimbabwe. They had both recently travelled outside of the country. Both people are stable and recovering in isolation at their respective homes. This brings to 16 the number of African countries now affected by the Mpox virus, according to the World Health Organization, with 7,500 confirmed cases and 32 deaths recorded so far this year.
Shinga Nyoka. In July, a man was shot dead in Pennsylvania after opening fire, killing one man and injuring former president and current presidential candidate Donald Trump. In September, a man was arrested after an apparent assassination attempt at Mr. Trump's golf course in Florida. Now, police in California say they've arrested a man with guns in his car near the former president's rally on Sunday. Chad Bianco is the local Riverside County Sheriff.
It's all going to be speculation about what his intentions were getting there. What we do know is he showed up with multiple passports with different names, an unregistered vehicle with fake license plate, and loaded firearms. If you're asking me right now, I probably did have deputies that prevented the third assassination attempt.
But the U.S. Secret Service says Mr. Trump was not in any danger and the detained man has been released on bail. Our North America correspondent Peter Bowes is following developments.
There's still a lot of questions to be answered on this, and the investigation is still ongoing. But we do have kind of different accounts or levels of speculation, you could say. And we've just heard from the sheriff there, Chad Bianco, acknowledging that it's difficult to speculate what the intent of this individual was. But he believes that his officers may well have prevented a third assassination attempt. Whereas federal officials, these are national officials, say from their investigation there is no indication that that was the intent of the suspect, although stressing the investigation continues. Now, some context here. The sheriff that we've just heard from is an elected official. He is a Republican. He has expressed and indeed continues to support Donald Trump. So any comments that he makes should at least be seen with that context in the background. Nevertheless, the facts are that this man, Van Miller, that was the name that he gave, although, as we've heard, there were multiple documents in his vehicle suggesting that he might have had several identities, or at least documents that would purport to have several identities. So that clearly is still under an investigation, but he did have guns and ammunition in his vehicle, and he had said that he was on the, or at least word to this effect, that he was on the VIP list to get into the event. When that didn't stand up and when the guns clearly were found, that's the point at which he was arrested.
That was Peter Bowes. The 90th Paris Motor Show takes place this week, showing off the latest tech on four wheels. It comes at an interesting time for the industry, as European car makers battle to stop cheaper Chinese electric vehicles from flooding the Western market. The BBC's business correspondent Theo Leggett is at the show, and he says there's a mixed mood in Paris.
The European companies aren't here in force. Yes, we've got the Renault Group because this is a home event for them. But Mercedes-Benz, for example, is not. And a number of the Japanese manufacturers are not here. There's no Nissan, there's no Toyota, there's no Honda. But what we have got is a list of companies with names that might not be quite so familiar. So XPeng, GAC, Skyworth, Maxus, Leapmotor, Hongqi, Forthing and BYD. And what those companies have in common is they're all from China.
And that's interesting in the context of new tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles, especially.
Yes. So Chinese manufacturers are making a concerted effort to increase their exports. And Europe is a market that they're targeting. Because although the European market is quite crowded, there's a lot of established manufacturers. They're all going to have to transfer from making petrol and diesel cars to making electric cars. And that creates an opportunity. And the Chinese manufacturers believe that they can make those cars more cheaply and make them better and take a slice of the cake. At least some European governments are quite concerned about this. They believe that Chinese manufacturers are unfairly subsidized by the Chinese government. And therefore, we recently had this move to impose very substantial tariffs or taxes that are up to 35%. But the evidence from the show is that's not deterring the Chinese manufacturers. They still want to enter this market.
As you say, there are some big names missing from this year's event. What is it actually for? What are we expecting to happen?
In the past, you had companies spending millions on having stands at these shows in order to posture and try and gain the headlines. But they were all competing with one another. And I think when the COVID pandemic came in and these shows were cancelled, a lot of the big manufacturers decided that they had other and better ways of spending their money. So a lot of them withdrew. But for those who are left, they can still monopolize the headlines. And what we're seeing at this show is a mixture of big manufacturers, many of them Chinese, showing their latest wares. So Renault, for example, will be showing their new Renault 4, a new car that builds on the heritage of the old boxy Renault 4 that you might remember from your childhood, Jackie. But what I'm really interested in is there's a lot of smaller manufacturers of sort of cute little city solutions, if you like. So, for example, Microlino, it's a spin-off of the Micro Scooter Company. That's come in with a rethought version of the bubble car from the 1960s, and it's all electric. And we're seeing quite a lot of that kind of thing now. So it's not just the big SUVs and the powerful cars. It's also these funky little solutions to how we're going to get around cities as cities get bigger and more crowded.
I know that you love a good car, Theo. Are you going to get to have a test drive of any of these cute little city solutions or anything else while you're there?
I don't think I'd dare to guess on the Paris roads. The traffic round here is awful, Jackie. And inside the show, they don't allow you to drive them. But I will say, I'm going to take a look at a few of the stands. So, and these city solutions, I'm really interested in them. Maybe they'll let me drive one of those around the show.
Maybe they will. That was Theo Leggett in Paris. Orchestra conductors are often known for their facial expressions, their charisma, their passion. Dresden Sinfonica's new conductor has none of those qualities, but does keep perfect rhythm. Anna Aslam reports.
As the orchestra plays, three bionic arms wielding glowing batons that look like Star Wars lightsabers move up and down to guide the musicians along. Myra Pro S, the robot conductor, made her much-awaited debut in the German city of Dresden this weekend. Some of the concert music was written explicitly to harness the technology, with 16 brass musicians and 4 percussionists playing wildly different time signatures. Myra is not the first robot conductor, but is perhaps the most technically advanced. Each baton guides a section of the orchestra as different parts speed up and slow down to create cross rhythms which would be impossible to conduct as a human. Dresden Sinfonica's artistic director Markus Rindt first thought of the idea more than 2 decades ago, when the musician complained about his conducting and he replied, "I'm not a robot." But he insists robots won't replace humans.
I believe a person can always do better. The rehearsal work, the facial expressions. If, for example, you were to play a Beethoven, you wouldn't need a robot like that. It's pointless. But if you have a piece that capitalizes on the fact that the orchestra plays at different speeds and different beats, then it makes sense.
Each robotic arm has 7 joints, allowing it to move and stretch in all directions. But if Myra gets a little too forceful, slamming down on a beat, a safety mechanism kicks in. One composer said the 2 years it took to train the machine made him realize just how wonderful a human conductor is.
That report by Anna Aslam. And that's it from us for now. There will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you'd like to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Daniel Fox. The producer was Stephanie Tillotson. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.